The Tom Woods Show, episode 921.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, chances are in your Facebook feed, you've got people telling you that you want children to die because you oppose Obamacare. Why, don't you know it saves 36,000 lives per year? Smash all this nonsense with my free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Healthcare. Pick it up at yourfriendsarewrong.com. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm joined once again by our old friend Gene Epstein, who is economics and book review editor over at Barron's, the nation's premier financial publication. Gene wrote to me the other day and said, you know, there's really an embarrassment of riches when it comes to presidential stupidity, when it comes to economics. And for some reason, the Trump phenomenon has made people forget our rich, rich history of presidential stupidity in this country. So we're going to revisit some of that rich history of presidential economic stupidity today in this very episode. Gene, welcome back.
Happy to be back, Tom.
All right, let me tell people, first of all, before you say anything, let me tell people that if you live in New York City, you have many, many wonderful things you can do. But if I lived in New York City, one of the great benefits I would think of is from living there is the Soho Forum. And I'm not saying that just because you're here. To have an intriguing, compelling, punchy, interesting, informative debate on a controversial topic month in and month out is an amazing privilege. Very few places on earth have something like that. And you can just step out of your house, go get on the subway, and you're there. So you've got one coming up very soon, I believe June 13th, in which you yourself are a participant. So go ahead and tell us about that and make sure to include the website.
Well, that's right, Tom, and thank you for that fulsome compliment. Mainly, my conception with the Soho Forum, which started, which launched last September, and we're now finishing our first season, and I'm already scheduling debates into our second season, is to see if I can lure progressives to debate libertarians. But of course, every once in a while, I have libertarians debating libertarians, since we libertarians do have some issues to settle. Now, this particular debate about Adam Smith has something to do with the Tom Woods Show. First of all, the two debaters, me and Mark Skousen, have been guests on the Tom Woods Show in the past. That's one tie-in. Second, when I wrote an article called The Trouble with Adam Smith. Actually, it was called The Problem with Adam Smith, come to think of it, The Problem. I then appeared on the Tom Woods Show to talk about what I perceive to be the problem with Adam Smith. That's episode 704 on the Tom Woods Show. You should put that, of course, in the link with the show notes page.
Of course.
And in response to my column, as well as the podcast that Mark Skousen heard, he challenged me to a debate about the value of Adam Smith's contribution. And Mark is going to be defending this proposition. Adam Smith should be honored as the founder of modern economics and free enterprise capitalism. Mark is going to be taking the affirmative, of course, and I'll be taking the negative. And I also want to make a special offer to people who either live in New York who might be traveling in Manhattan on Tuesday, June 13th. If you come to the debate, just walk up to me after the debate ends when our party starts. Just say the magic words, Tom Woods, and the Soho Forum will treat you to an alcoholic or non-alcoholic drink at our cash bar. The food is free. So just say Tom Woods, and you can, and you'll be entitled to a drink as well as to a conversation even with the likes of me, unless, of course, you prefer to talk to Mark. He'll also be available. Now, the website is thesohoforum.org, spelled continuously, THE, Soho Forum. newyorkindex.org. So I hope anybody listening can come. If you live in the New York area, please come. If you're traveling through, please come. We're in downtown Manhattan at 45 Bleecker Street, a very charming sort of funky theater that seats about 200 people. I'll look forward to seeing everyone there at the Soho Forum Tuesday, June 13th.
Well, any event where the magic words are Tom Woods is a good event in my book.
Absolutely. Yes.
All right. You're crazy not to take Gene up on that tremendous offer. So do check out that
Absolutely.
Website. All right. I'll also put the link to the Soho Forum on the show notes page, which, by the way, is tomwoods.com/921. And I always put all your previous episodes on every show notes page when you're on.
Much appreciated.
All right. Let's get into the topic for today, which comes from some recent writing you did, Bipartisan Moronics.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess the gist of it is that we're getting, once again, this idea that there's something uniquely stupid about the statements made about economics by Donald Trump. And your argument is, actually, if it's stupidity regarding economics you're looking for, why, it's an embarrassment of riches throughout American history.
Yes.
And we need go back only one administration to start looking for it.
No, it is indeed the case, Tom. As a libertarian, I not only care about economics. I actually take Walter Block's point that while we economists like to think that economics matters most, the truth is that foreign policy and American militarism matters is a much bigger problem. So I like you and like other libertarians, I sort of groan with disbelief when I read the New York Times and other publications talking about how Donald Trump is somehow sui generis. He's somehow a downright moron. The downright moron, by the way, that H.L. Mencken predicted would ultimately occupy the White House. I begin with an H.L. Mencken quote, and because my beat is economics, I felt that I was obligated to discuss only moron economics of past administrations. And I was especially inspired that particular week because Jimmy Carter, who some of you might remember, was the president of the United States from 1977 to 1981, published an op-ed piece a few days before in the Washington Post in which he endorsed the clueless view of cross-border trade held by Donald Trump. So this was a bipartisan, across-the-table gesture from several presidents ago to endorse the ugliness of Donald Trump's imposition of tariffs on Canadian lumber. And so I thought, well, what a beautiful tie-in to sort of show that moronomics knows no party boundaries, and that Carter, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, any of them have come up with just some incredible statements about economics that sort of lower the bar down to imbecility. I don't know which one you want to choose. Although I think, by the way, that you probably could sort of conduct this interview with yourself, Tom, because your knowledge of the moron and offensive statements on politics, offensive actions on politics, also, of course, would be part of my point, which is that there's something. What I confess to, I guess I could say, my worst confession at the end of the column is that I take a certain perverse pleasure. I admit it's perverse. It's a guilty pleasure in seeing this bozo, Donald Trump, pose as president, because I think he sort of lets it all hang out. It's perversely satisfying to see this guy make it so obvious that he'll say anything that comes to mind. Previous presidents were much more slick. Barack Obama, in particular, of course, had a much slicker veneer than Donald Trump. But at heart, I believe that he's the same fool we all have to suffer every time we listen, almost every time we listen to somebody in the White House. So I don't know where you want me to start, although, again, you could probably weigh in on politics for sure and economics as well. So where should we start?
Well, I like the order you go in your column. Well, you actually start with Carter, and what I like about it is, when I first looked at it, you had emailed it to me, so I had 12 things going on, and I was glancing at this email, and I actually thought I was reading Donald Trump.
Oh yeah.
Because could you imagine if Donald Trump, when justifying tariffs on Canadian timber, actually said, could you imagine if he said, timber sales are a major source of income for my own family? Could you imagine the outrage at this? And yet Carter actually said that.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's right. That's another key point, which is indeed that some of these statements they make would be, my God, the New York Times would really pounce. What's interesting is that I guess Trump, I don't know if Trump would actually say that. Of course, the New York Times would immediately know that the Trump administration is in the timber business and would point it out. But it's interesting that Carter, in his own delusional state, seems to think that this is a card to play, that his family has suffered. He wants himself put up as kind of one of those New York Times anecdotes about how we've suffered because of what Canada has been doing, and therefore this should sort of get your heart to bleed so that we can be protected, so I think ironically Trump might have been a little bit more discreet about it, although of course anybody would have known that it's a source of income for his family. Carter came out right out and said it because he thought, this is a way to get people to sympathize.
Yeah, so it's crazy.
I think they put it from different perspectives.
No, but I like also this quotation: "There is enough timberland in the United States to supply the total American market with lumber. So, therefore, what need have we for international trade?" How would you respond to that?
Yeah, right. Well, there have to be, I mean, I use the analogy, you just sort of don't know where to start by talking about this idea that we have enough timberland to supply the market. So I just used the idea of time, the Austrian concept. To notice what I wrote is, similarly, there's enough time in our day to perform services we purchase from others, I wrote, but since time is scarce, we devote it to more productive uses while outsourcing so much else. There's enough time in our day to give ourselves haircuts, to wash our own clothes, to do whatever else we need to do to grow, of course, our own food if we have a backyard. We can do all those things, but obviously in a division of labor society, we know that we're going to impoverish ourselves unless we learn how to allocate that scarce commodity, which is time, properly. And similarly, of course, virtually anything you can imagine, I guess with the exception of rare metals and rare raw materials, the U.S. could produce on its own. Certainly timberland, certainly if we wanted to, if one of the frackers who bring oil out of the ground for about $50 a barrel to bring oil out of the ground and at the margin for $60, $70, $80, $90, $100 a barrel, whatever the cost, the U.S. could be completely self-sufficient in oil. We could probably go grow coffee as long as we spent a fortune of money and grew it in greenhouses. And so we could all do all of those things and impoverish ourselves in the process. So when Carter talks about enough timberland, once again, the moron economics involved is not to recognize what had been established a couple of centuries ago, that the division of labor society is not just a domestic division of labor, but an international division of labor, and that if people can buy cheaper lumber from Canada than they can get in the United States, then that's where they're going to buy that lumber. That was, again, Carter's obvious gaffe in that regard. But the fact that this was published as an op-ed in the Washington Post, that it was a completely, apparently, respectable position, is part of the gasp-provoking nature of what presidents are able to say. I did want, in the column, as you notice, I did want at least to reference Carter's crisis of confidence speech, in which he counseled Americans against piling up material goods. He did this from the comfort of the White House. That was another, this, of course, anticipated the environmentalists, of whom Carter is one, who counsel us all to make do with less. Al Gore and most of these others, we would like to have some of their less, since these people make do with more. So that was Carter. Then I went on to Obama, I quoted him on cheap tires, that Barack Obama claimed credit for measures to ensure that China was not flooding our domestic market with cheap tires, as though cash-strapped Americans should pay more for tires than they needed to. And Obama fanned the flames of chauvinist hatred of foreigners by baiting Republican challenger Mitt Romney as the last person who's going to get tough on China with respect to trade. You know, the China bashing of Obama, sort of the ugly, sort of quasi-racist hatred of China because they sell cash-strapped Americans cheap goods. That was one of Obama's stocks in trade.
Right. Let me jump in on that. Sure, let me jump in on the tire thing, because Walter Williams had a great commentary specifically on the tire thing.
Yeah.
He said, because it was in his State of the Union in 2012, he boasted about that again. Mm-hmm. And he said over 1,000 Americans are working today because we stopped a surge in Chinese tires. Well, the Peterson Institute found that because of those trade restrictions, Americans wound up paying $1.1 billion in higher prices for tires. So they did save 1,200 jobs, but the cost per job saved was about $900,000. Yeah. Now, given that each job pays about $40,000, that's vastly disproportionate.
Yes, sure, absolutely. Let me cut to since we're talking about Obama. Actually, it was Ron Paul who got me. I remember watching a brief video when the Cash for Clunkers program was brought out by Obama, and Ron Paul commented on it, and that's when that brief item inspired me to write about it in my own column. The cash for clunkers, if you think about it, really, of course, I guess it anticipates the other ways in which government literally destroys a commodity in order to supposedly help the market. The cash for clunkers program involved, if you have a car that is deemed a clunker, that deemed is an old car, then you can hand it in and the government will give you cash for it. And then you can use that cash to buy another car. This was supposedly a wildly successful program in the eyes of Secretary Lay LaHood. But, Ron Paul, who's like, twice as smart an economist as virtually any of the so-called economists, immediately pointed out what this basically involved was an assault on the economic well-being of poor people who have to drive those clunkers. According to the records, 700,000 clunkers were destroyed and new cars were bought in their place. I added to Ron Paul's indictment of this crazy policy by the Obama administration by suggesting my own Shekels for Shacks program, whereby if you live in a dwelling that the government deems to be ramshackle, then it can be burned down, it could be torn, they can take the wrecker ball to it, they'll give you cash for it, and you can move into another home. So again, we can go hog wild with this idea of destroying the durable goods that people of limited means may own in order to get them to buy other goods. But obviously, when you make these goods scarcer, you're making it harder for other people to buy the clunkers or to buy homes that are run down or to buy any good that the government deems to be low on the scale. So again, the whole idea of the Obama administration is helping poor people is sort of given the lie by that insane Cash for Clunkers program. I did say when I proposed the Shekels for Shacks program, I did have to say, just kidding, guys, just to make sure that nobody took me seriously.
Right, of course. Now, then in later in your column, you talk about Hillary Clinton, who in one of the debates said that the Great Recession, and these are her words, occurred because in large part because of tax policies that slash taxes on the wealthy. So apparently if you slash taxes on the wealthy, you get a housing bubble that leads to a financial crisis. What is the cause and effect there?
Well, indeed, it was hard to make even good nonsense out of that point. But it is worth elaborating on in a couple of ways. First, when I'd written about it in an earlier column when she actually made that statement, and it turned out that the top 1% or the top 5% when there was a cut in the marginal tax on the top rate, they paid something like, you know, if they were paying, you know, 60%, they were paying 58%. It was like a 2% decline in what they were actually paying. And how could this possibly cause anything, any kind of crash? And I pointed out as well that, I mean, this wasn't even the crazy idea about what caused the Great Recession by the progressives. The progressives were saying, of course, it was deregulation and greed, you know, a greater amount of greed and a certain amount of deregulation, and that's what brought the Great Recession. None of them were saying that slashing taxes on the wealthy was the cause. So it's hard to know exactly how Hillary got this idea, but then, you know, it did occur to me the other day in going over my notes again that there's a brief section in Thomas Piketty's book about inequality in which he makes this suggestion. There's even a suggestion that this helped caused the Great Depression of the 1930s. And I have to say, in one perverse sense, Hillary Clinton, I guess, put herself into good company by blurting out this crazy statement, although it isn't very popularly put forward, and Piketty didn't put it forward very aggressively. But this constant sort of flirting with the idea that if you cut taxes on the wealthy and they're not paying enough into government, then that's going to cause an economic downturn, or if the wealthy are earning too much, that's going to cause an economic downturn. Again, it's almost, if you start trying to unravel this idea, start trying to explain it, you're almost dignifying it, because again, it's the old, I guess it was the Will Rogers line, this doesn't even make good nonsense. So that was Hillary's line. I mean, Hillary's other statements about economics, about finance, you know, one of her famous gaffes was when she and Bill were poor and struggling, and she made over $100,000 trading the cattle futures market. When she was initially asked, how did she do this? She said, well, I read the Wall Street Journal, which of course was indeed, if all it takes to make $100,000 in the cattle futures market is to read the Wall Street Journal, then most of us are sort of missing out on making good money in investment. But again, she was stupid enough to say that, although of course later she was embarrassed out of it, but she did make that statement initially to the press when she was asked.
All right, let's look at I like this example that you have in here from some of the material you sent me from JFK. There are a lot of people who have a soft spot for JFK, or they think maybe he was assassinated because he was too good, or he was trying to overturn the Fed, which he wasn't. I think in part it's this view. There are some, I mean, it's not really the libertarians. It's more the, I don't know, there's some group in the Ron Paul people who just,
really,
they love the idea that there's some president who was trying to do right and the bad guys got, like, you get this fake quotation from Woodrow Wilson all the time where he supposedly said, oh, I've sold out my country to the banksters by creating the Federal Reserve. What an unhappy man I am. That's a made up quotation. He was very proud of creating the Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm. But they fall for this because they want to believe there was this white knight president out there for our good. It's just too hard for them to believe they were all a bunch of creeps.
Yeah.
So let's go with JFK and farm subsidies.
Yeah.
During the campaign, he said against Nixon, the family farm should remain the backbone of American agriculture, and the decline in agricultural income is the number one domestic problem in the United States.
Yeah.
And then in the Kennedy-Nixon debates, if you don't have the passage in front of you that Kennedy said,
no,
I'll read it now.
I do.
Okay, yeah, read what Kennedy said about this.
Yeah. No, you know, by the way, the what impressed me by looking it up, you know, I actually remembered this vividly when I was Nixon listening to the Kennedy debates with Nixon. Nixon was certainly sounder on the subject than Kennedy, although Nixon, of course, Mr. Price controlled Richard Nixon, had his own problems. But what's interesting is that the questioner actually sounds pretty sophisticated. And that's the part that surprised me. You know, this is like 1960 when you wonder, did anybody have some sense of the free market? This questioner named Warren asks him, why can't the farmer operate like the businessman who operates a factory? If an auto company overproduces a certain model car, Uncle Sam doesn't step in and buy up the surplus. Why this constant courting of the farmer? So Kennedy responded, in part, if the agricultural economy collapses, then the economy of the rest of the United States sooner or later will collapse. The farmers are the number one market for the automobile industry of the United States. The automobile industry is the number one market for steel. An amazing statement with respect to that one transition, that the farmers are the number one market for the automobile industry of the United States. That was just insane. And of course, obviously, if Donald Trump had made that remark at the time, then the progressive press would have been all over him with that ignorant statement, for that ignorant statement. But, you know, again, the agricultural economy is going to collapse unless, of course, we have price controls and we have set-asides and we have aid for the farmer. But, you know, Kennedy was clearly tapping a certain romanticism about the farmer that I guess people are still afflicted with the family farm, all the rest of it, as though the family farm is more important than the family business, although, of course, to some degree, of course, the mom-and-pop shops are also romanticized, even though, you know, it's hard to make a decent salary. If you work for a mom-and-pop shop or for a family farm, they generally don't pay benefits. The larger companies do. The family farm doesn't. And so he was clearly trying to press this button with these ignorant statements about the agricultural economy. We certainly have come away since then. You know, I think, isn't it difficult to find a politician willing to defend America's aid to farmers and farm subsidies these days? A little bit, much harder than it used to be. All they do is sort of attribute it to the fact that the farm bloc has so much power in the Senate. So we've advanced a little bit since then. But, you know, with respect to Kennedy, by the way, you mentioned the Fed, and, you know, one of the, I was having trouble finding this reference, but I know this is true, that Kennedy was so dim-witted about economics and how the government worked that he couldn't get it straight as to what the Federal Reserve actually did. What was it, you know, fiscal policy, monetary policy? He had difficulty with that. And so an aide gave him a mnemonic. Luckily, the guy who headed the Fed was William McChesney Martin. And so working from that M in the front of in William McChesney Martin's name, he was able to associate that with monetary policy. So he barely knew anything about these things. But of course, when you mention Kennedy, I mean, I am interested in the idea that there are libertarians who, you know, searching for that white knight will search out Kennedy. I mean, why was he arguably our worst president? Because he almost, you know, now I'm going to quote Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis, which almost ended the world with nuclear war, as Chomsky summarized it in one sentence by saying, we risked nuclear war to establish the principle that we and we alone had the right to put nuclear missiles off the border of another country. You know, that was the principle, that we and we alone have the right. Since we had missiles in Turkey, that was okay. If the Soviet Union put missiles in Cuba, that was not okay. And actually, if you read about what happened, there almost was a nuclear war in the Caribbean from a Russian nuclear submarine. So that's the insanity that Kennedy unleashed. And to talk about him as having any virtues whatsoever as a president, that is indeed appalling.
You've got a bunch of stuff here in this material. Yeah. You've got, and in fact, when you mentioned I mean, Daniel Patrick Moynihan could be cited on quite a number of grounds here. You've got, well, in particular, though, you mentioned Noam Chomsky. That's what made me think of Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Because Chomsky tells a story about Moynihan at the UN. Now, you, neither you nor I are particular fans of the UN. So, but can you still tell us the story of Indonesia and, and Moynihan's, what and he was up to?
No, see, this is the thing about, I am still working, by the way, on a book called Dear Noam Chomsky. And in fact, with Jeremy Hammond, who's been on your show, Jeremy and I are both, he's three decades younger than I, but we are oddly ideological brothers in that we're deeply influenced by Murray Rothbard and Noam Chomsky, even though, of course, Rothbard and Chomsky didn't get along, but Chomsky and Rothbard influenced us both. And so we're working on a book called Dear Noam Chomsky, and Chomsky has said he's going to respond to our criticisms of his blind spots about free market economics. But what is some of the value about Noam Chomsky? I sent you an excerpt from a letter I wrote Chomsky recently. Jeremy and I are both writing fan letters to him, and then our next chapter is a very harsh criticism of some of his views. But this is the amazing thing for me about Chomsky, is that he would come up with the most amazing statements that came from our establishment, that you'd rub your eyes in disbelief that they actually said these things and they actually meant them. But when he quoted from Moynihan's, Daniel Patrick Moynihan had been ambassador to the UN, and when he quoted from Moynihan's memoir about what happened and what he did while being ambassador, I could not believe that, and I had to buy the book. In fact, I now have a couple of copies, which I show people, because I couldn't believe that Moynihan was brazen enough to admit to what he had done. He specifically says that Indonesia invaded East Timor. At the time, then he also specifically says that they were slaughtering about 10% of the population. And then he even specifically says that proportionately, this would be like slaughtering a few million Americans. So he admits to the crime. But then, if you know anything about the background on this, this was under Ford and Kissinger. Ford was president at the time. And the Indonesians were using American weaponry to slaughter the East Timorese. And under Kissinger, Moynihan was told to hamper any attempt on the part of the UN to stop the slaughter. And he writes brazenly, after admitting to the fact that this was wanton slaughter, he writes, "The United States wished things to turn out as they did and worked to bring this about." Which how they turned out, 10% of the East Timorese were slaughtered. "The Department of State desired that the United Nations prove utterly ineffective in whatever measures it undertook. This task was given to me, and I carried it forward with no inconsiderable success." So he's bragging about being successful in thwarting any attempt on the part of the UN to stop the slaughter. And so anybody who wants to name a highway or whatever else after Daniel Patrick Moynihan, I show them this passage. I show them these two pages. I show them it's unequivocal that the man is admitting to having been a party to slaughter. By the way, whenever anybody tells me that Gerald Ford was a decent man, I also point out that I guess maybe he's as decent as they come for recent American president. But in fact, Gerald Ford and Kissinger met with Suharto of Indonesia and gave them the go-ahead to allow them to slaughter the East Timorese with American weaponry. And that's why they told Moynihan to make sure that any attempt on the part of the UN to thwart the Indonesians' government in its slaughter of the East Timorese should be thwarted. And that's what Moynihan is bragging about. So this is also a story about that supposedly decent man, Gerald Ford, who took over from Richard Nixon.
Well, this escalated quickly. We started with tariffs on lumber, and
well, that's right.
Here we are here we are with the East Timorese.
Well, exactly. Well, the slaughter of innocent people the nuclear war that John F. Kennedy almost started. And again, that's because, as I said, Walter Block is right. Now, Walter Block is wrong about a few things. You and I disagree with him about a few things. But as Walter Block said, much as we economists like to think that economics is very important, I write a column on the economy, and I very, very rarely take the prerogative of saying anything about politics, since my readers are supposed to think, well, that's my expertise is economics, and that's what I write about. But of course, talking on the Tom Woods show as a libertarian, I cannot refrain from pointing out with Walter Block that certain things, certain actions, not just imbecilic statements and decisions, but absolutely horrifying decisions have come from presidents prior to Donald Trump. And Donald Trump hasn't as yet equaled some of the horrific actions of our former presidents. Let's hope that he continues to fall short in that regard.
Well, maybe we should ratchet it down a little bit before we say goodbye for today. Do you want to pick one more act of just plain idiocy?
Just plain idiocy. Let me.
Well, there's always Bill Clinton and housing.
Bill Clinton. Yeah, Bill Clinton. You know, when I asked, you know, there was a movie called Inside Job that won the Academy Award. And it was produced by a guy named Charles Ferguson. I wrote about that film, and I interviewed. In fact, Charles Ferguson was at least kind enough, open enough, to spend an hour talking to me about his movie on the phone. He probably knew that I was going to be critical of his film. In any case, when he did win the Academy Award, the first thing he said before the Academy was in, do you know, not a single person who caused this crisis has as yet been indicted. And so when I asked Una MacDonald, a British author who's written about the financial bubble, who was the first person she would want to indict if she were indicting anybody, and she said, well, obviously Bill Clinton. You know, Bill Clinton was the one who picked up the baton from George H.W. Bush, his predecessor, who had already taken a legislative initiative to get the U.S. Government into affordable mortgages, but he brought it to a new level. He said it would not cost taxpayers a dime. He imposed through HUD the requirements on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the mortgage finance companies, to continue to buy up high-risk mortgages. So he essentially started the housing bubble going, and his successor, by the way, George W. Bush, also picked up the baton. You know, one of the jokes about, one of the things that did make me laugh was that George W. Bush, when he furthered the housing goals of essentially giving poor people down payments and then expecting them to be able to pay these mortgages, that's essentially what caused the bubble, what caused the housing collapse. He literally said, we have a housing misallocation. We have housing inequality in this country. We don't have enough poor people who own houses. And what made me laugh about that is that Krugman thought it was appalling to think that the Republican administration did this because they were concerned about inequality. In fact, George W. Bush made it specifically known that the inequality of housing ownership was what motivated him. In any case, Bill Clinton was really the central actor in all this. He said this will not cost taxpayers a dime. It ended up costing taxpayers, you know, $1 trillion at least. And so that was Bill Clinton and the destructiveness that he unleashed on his watch.
Well, I think we'll leave it there. That's about enough idiocy for one episode, I would say.
Yeah. So,
but people should of course check out Barron's, by the way, where you write.
Thank
and
you.
You've been, how long have you been with Barron's?
25 years.
Wow, how about that? Okay, well, it's barrons.com, just what you would think, with two R's, barrons.com. And show notes page, tomwoods.com/921. But definitely check out that page in particular to get either that or just go directly to thesohoforum.org, because you've got to start going to these debates. You guys have debated such interesting topics with so many interesting people. I'm telling you, if I lived in New York, I would never miss one. I would never. I would cancel with other people. I would make excuses. I would lie just flat out to be able to make sure I got to the Soho Forum. So best of luck with that, Gene.
Nobody can match your enthusiasm, Tom, and I welcome that. I'm also, by the way, negotiating with Bob Murphy to find a proper adversary for him, and someday Tom Woods might even participate, have a rematch with Michael Malice. But meanwhile, there'll be me and Mark Skousen squaring off on Tuesday, June 13th. Please come.
Well, I'll say this. Mark's been a guest on the show, and yes, he and I have never had any unfriendliness, but I'll just whisper here that I hope you win.
Thank you very much.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Gene. See you later.
Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. I hope you're going to be attending my 1,000th episode extravaganza in Orlando on September 9th. More details to come in the coming days. I also hope you will check out a brand new site called, well, new-ish, but new to you, certainly, rchobbyreview.com. rchobbyreview.com was created by a listener of this show, and it is a site you would want to visit if you are in the market for a drone or a quadcopter, and you want to learn how to use them and what the best one is to get, what the best cheap one is to get. All kinds of material like that is available at rchobbyreview.com. So I'm going to link to that at tomwoods.com/921 as today's listener website mentioned. And of course, remember, you get a shout out on my show and all kinds of goodies and privileges, including membership in my secret bloggers group, where you can get all the help you need getting started. All you got to do is use my link when you get your web hosting. So get all the details regarding all the neat bonuses I give you for free if you use that link. Check it all out at tomwoods.com/publicity. All right. By the way, next week is the week starting June 5th. I'm going to be out of town. In fact, even earlier than that, I'll be out of town. I'm going to be in New York, and I'm going to be in Boston. And yet, the episodes are just going to keep on coming. How about that? I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.